This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings once again to everybody at TFMR. All right, it is time for this week's Thursday conversation. And of course, this one is being recorded late Tuesday, so I'm not sure how that works, but we're going to still use the term Thursday conversation. You know what these are. This is a chance to just get the quick perspective, hit a few main points with some of the smartest people that I know. I became acquainted, I guess, a couple of years ago with today's featured guest, and then I got a chance to actually speak with him about 6 months ago, and I'm talking about David Rosenberg. David is an economist, I guess is what we'll call you by trade, though I don't want to slander you that way, David. But so don't take that personally. I called you an economist. But he's one that gets it, man. I mean, he fits right in with the way I look at the world, the way many of you look at the world. So, David, thank you. I really appreciate you taking some time to visit.
Well, it's an honor, and it's a pleasure to be on your call.
All right, my friend. We've been trying to get together for a couple of months, and we've had to postpone because you've been starting your own firm. So please, just in your own words, tell everybody a little bit about who you are, how people can learn more about you through Twitter or whatever, and then your Rosenberg Research and Associates, your new firm.
That's right. Launched on January the 6th after more than 30 years of being an economist at large institutions, both on the sell side and on the buy side. Made my name, I suppose, in my 10 years at Merrill Lynch. From 1999 to 2009, and the last seven of those years as chief economist in New York. And then the past decade was at Gluskin Sheff, a wealth management firm in Toronto. So I've had the benefit of my career of being both on the sell side and on the buy side on Wall Street and on Bay Street. So I've got multiple perspectives. And decided at the age of 59, before adding another zero, to chase my dream, which was to start my own economics and strategy research firm. And I guess if I have a claim to fame or how I end up cutting my teeth with the great mentors I've had, is basically taking the economic data points globally and connecting the dots to the financial markets. Because if you're an economist on the street, because there's all sorts of economists, whether it's at the conference board or the central banks or the Cato Institute. But when you're a street economist, to use that colloquial, your responsibility is to take those economic data points, connect the dots, and formulate a cogent and coherent investment strategy for investors out of that. And so that's really what I've always done. And the beauty about starting my own firm is that I call the shots, I get to direct the research, I get to pour my own resources into this. And having an independent voice today, providing unique research that isn't encumbered by the positioning or the product pitch of the firm you're working for, to have really that to have that unique and independent viewpoint that's unbiased is rare today. And I've been itching to do this for a long time. And so January the 6th, we launched. I've got a wide suite of products and services for every type of investor. And that's always what I've wanted to do.
Wonderful. Isn't it great? I broke free myself about 10 years ago and just never regretted it. Ups, downs, all that kind of stuff, but you'll never regret it. And I encourage everybody, look, I'll put a link on here to your website. I'll put a link on to your Twitter feed, because anytime there's an economic data point, certainly the ones of significance, whether it's the PMIs or the U.S. employment data or anything, I'm always looking at your Twitter feed to see what really happened, because as you said, you know, what was Jim Sinclair's old term was MOPE, management of perceptions, right?
Right.
You're able to see right through that. And I think that's invaluable. So please, everybody, check out Rosenberg Research and Associates. David, let's start with this. You have been, and I've been, again, by following you through Twitter, and then when we spoke before last year, first brought money, you've been kind of on the same path looking at this, you know, from the upper level looking down economically, macroeconomically, that we've been at here at TF Metals Report. I mean, I did late 2018. I remember Jan Hatzius at Goldman Sachs talking about 4 rate hikes in 19 and how the 10-year was going to 5%. And people would say, Craig, I would sit there and say, that's crazy. And people would say, Craig, what do you mean? You're not Jan Hatzius. He knows what he's doing. But you knew that was bogus too. We watched the global economy slow last year. Now, look, we're going to talk about what happened today in the Fed and the impacts of the virus here in a minute. But you, what were you already expecting this year? I'm just curious to see if it kind of jibes with what I was thinking.
Well, look, I was expecting that the 10-year note, just to use that, say, as the benchmark, that we're going to see the 10-year Treasury note yield approach or get to 1% by the end of the year. And here we actually did that today. Being 10 months early, I still think, by the way, that rates are going to go down even further and probably to or below levels that even I'd been predicting several months ago. But my view this year was it didn't matter to me whether the U.S. actually fell into an NBER-defined technical recession. My view was that we were going to see a pivot between two very powerful curves, aggregate demand, aggregate supply, where demand was going to slow below supply, and that was going to create the conditions for whether or not we actually had a recession, weak economic growth, and disinflationary pressure, Fed ease, and lower interest rates, and within the stock market to be focused on the safe haven yield plays. Of course, that's come to fruition early, and of course, we've had this massive shock to confidence from the coronavirus. But my view was that there is no get-out-of-jail-free card when you come off a year, as we did last year, where the consumer did hang in very nicely, yes, indeed. But we did have a recession in manufacturing. We did have a recession in business capital spending. And we did have a recession in corporate profits. And all these things end up leading to weaker employment. And the weaker employment will then filter into a weaker consumer, which, of course, is 70% of GDP and very difficult to get an outright recession without the consumer joining in, given the huge share it has in the economy. But my phraseology or my theme this year was that the impairment to the business sector last year was going to spill over with a lag into the household sector in 2020.
And you could see, obviously, what's going on in Germany. In the EU before this virus stuff hit too. I mean, the German economy is in recession too, is it not?
It's well, I would say we're that close. Technically it's close. So, well, it's close almost everywhere. I mean, even in the United States, we have this comfort feeling with 2% growth, say, in the fourth quarter, and yet all the growth came from two sources, declining imports and the arithmetic from that in the GDP and government spending. I mean, outside of those two sources, there was no growth. Flat in Germany, flat actually through most of Europe, including the UK. And you could argue that we are probably in a post-sales tax shock recession in Japan, quite unexpectedly. China, which has probably entered into a recession, but even before the coronavirus hit, and here you have China with a 16% share of GDP, world's second largest economy. I mean, the Chinese economy had already slowed down to its slowest level in 3 decades. The other giant in Asia, which is India, its slowest growth rate in a decade. So taking the U.S. aside, and the U.S., of course, widely viewed as the cleanest shirt in the laundry basket, although I would argue that shirt is still quite soiled, but yeah. And, you know, the old saying, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And I guess the one-eyed man has been and remains the United States. That much is true. But in absolute terms, look, I remember when I started in the business in the mid-80s, if we started talking about growth between 1% and 2%, we'd be talking about that as a growth recession. Or we'd be saying, you know, we're at stall speed. Today, it's just, you know, the mindset's been changed so dramatically that as long as they have a plus sign in front of it, then it's fine. But the reality is that when you look at the whole global economy together It's the weakest. I'm talking about heading into the corona crisis, the coronavirus. Maybe we should call it the corona crisis. the global economy was already slowing down precipitously.
Right.
Heading into this, now, even with the United States, you know, hovering in around 2% at the headline GDP level, it was very precarious, very fragile. And the point I was making, and look, who even heard of the coronavirus before the end of December? But the point I was making is that growth rate globally was so low and the fragility so acute that we were just one shock away. Like a lot of us would be talking about, well, cyber, what if there's a cyber attack, or what if Iran hits back and causes some sort of shock? So we're talking cyber here. We were talking about some, say, geopolitical. And then all of a sudden we get hit with this global health scare. And that's all it really takes. We don't have a big cushion. This is not the 1980s or the 1990s or even a good part of the 2000s where we had a cushion of growth in the U.S. of, say, 3%, globally of, call it, 5, 6%. That cushion is gone. So we were always just one shock, whatever the exogenous shock was going to be, from generating the conditions for a global economic downturn. And that is exactly what the markets are pricing in today. Of course, the Treasury market saw this ahead of the stock market.
Yep.
But the Treasury market is always really the best leading indicator.
Yes.
And so that's what's happening right now. And I'd say in the old days when we actually had a nice cushion of growth, we'd say, well, we're taking a haircut. But this is something a lot different, because a recession is different than just a growth turndown. A growth turndown is you take the Lamborghini down from 80 miles an hour down to 40 or down to 30 miles an hour. When you go into reverse, that's like a national or even a global pay cut. And that operates a little differently in terms of what it means for corporate cash flows, what it means for spending, and what it means for financial market performance.
Yeah, and servicing the existing debt. And servicing all the continuing accumulation of debt. All these things factor into the Fed mindset, I suppose. I know it's a gross oversimplification to just simply hang it on the yield curve, but how much of an oversimplification is it, Dave? Because I look at that, you know, we've been talking on my site, I mean, all through last year, that the Fed was being painted into a corner by the bond market. And I mean, the last 2 weeks, we've gone from, I guess, a kind of relatively flat, positively sloping yield curve to thing that something was inverted all the way out to the long bond. The reason I asked this question is because even with the 50 basis points today, the effective Fed funds rate's 115, and the bond market, especially the short end, soared today. The bond prices did. The 2-year note's down 70 basis points. So they're still 25 to 50 basis points behind the curve in that regard. I mean, do you think that, like I said, how much of an oversimplification is it to just simply, you know, to factor that in? I mean, because there's so many other things going on.
Well, look, I think that what's really important here is not necessarily the shape of the yield curve. I mean, of course, that matters for the banks and their net interest margins. But when you get to these microscopic level of interest rates, the yield curve gives you less and less predictive power. We've had recessions in Japan, and in fact, we might be in one right now. The yield curve there didn't invert. We already had a recession in this period of post-financial crisis recovery. Well, we had a recession actually in Europe, in the euro area, and the yield curve didn't invert. So you get to these levels of interest rates, it's not about the yield curve. What you want to focus on is the long end of the curve. What is 10-year yields, 30-year yields telling you? The direction of long-term interest rates as opposed to the curve. And it's telling you about the forces of deflation. It's telling you about the imbalance between savings and investment. And it's telling you about the direction of economic growth. So I've been focused, because I'll tell you that, you know, being in this business 35 years, I've always been an adherent to the yield curve as the best leading indicator. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's perfect, because nothing is perfect. And the bulls will always say, well, but it missed this recession and it missed that recession, but it's got like an 85% track record. But the yield curve is not really what I've been focused on for the better part of the past year. It's it's really been the direction of long-term interest rates. And I want to make the point that you brought up, which is the extreme level of global indebtedness. This might be one of the reasons why the Fed feels compelled to cut interest rates, is they know that they can't. Unfortunately, the FOMC is filled with economists, and I say this as an economist. It's too bad that they don't have more infectious disease specialists on the FOMC. But their specialty is not coming up with a vaccine. They know that they can't really fight this, really, first and foremost, a global supply shock in terms of the supply chains and the implications for production and shutdowns. But now you get to something where, there's no interest rate antidote for, say, closing down events and empty airplanes and hotel rooms and places of the world that are quarantined that has this impact on aggregate demand. I think that the Fed probably is thinking we got to get rates down because there's so many marginal companies out there. When you think about the fact that we have, $3.5 trillion of outstanding corporate debt, and half of that is really in the most spurious parts of the quality curve, and there's going to be a lot of debt financings going on, refinancings, that we've got to grease the wheels to enable these companies to roll over their debt without defaulting or going delinquent or creating some sort of second-round credit squeeze. And that, I think, has got to be first and foremost on the Fed's mind. I don't think they're just stopping with interest rates in this regard because it's the second round impacts that are going to matter on the credit market. Of course, we're all focused on the stock market, but people don't realize when they talk about, well, interest rates are going down, how wonderful that is. Yeah, if you're a government borrower in the municipal market or in a federal market, well, as a government borrower, that's all great, but the wrong interest rate's going down. Interest rates in the high yield market have gone up about 100 basis points in the past month. And that's where a lot of corporations borrow. They don't borrow at the government rate. And I'll tell you that, this is the year of the rat in the Chinese zodiac. And the title of my presentation is It's the Year of the Rat and I Smell One. But I'll tell you that I really started to smell the rat last year. When you consider that the Fed cut rates three times last year, with the unemployment rate of 3.5%. How often has that happened in the past?
Right.
And what the Fed realized that in this regard, that Donald Trump was right, that actually the Fed did over-tighten, and the Fed's estimate of this elusive concept of a neutral policy rate that is actually was a lot lower than what Jay Powell thought when he took over the helm in January 2018. And I think this is very critical, that to me, I started getting, you could call it more cautious, more bearish. I would just say more concerned about the outlook in general. When the Fed got stopped out at 2.5%, I mean, here you have the Fed screaming and a lot of the hawks in the Fed screaming that they had to get the funds rate above 3%.
Right.
And here they got stopped out at 2.5%. Think about that for a second. The Fed has not been stopped out. We have not seen such a low cyclical peak in the policy rate since the 1930s. Just think about how pathetic it is that we could not get the Fed funds rate above 2.5% this cycle. That was an alarm bell for me 14 months ago.
Yeah. Well, and for good reason, David. And we've seen the repo and liquidity crisis that sprung up in September and October and has continued. You talk about that, the Fed getting stopped out. What it took them 5 years to trim $750 billion off the balance sheet, and they put $400 billion back on in 5 months? So, and it's impossible to say how this virus is ultimately going to impact things in the quarters ahead, the months ahead. But a decrease in tax receipts is only going to cause more funding issues for the government, and issues at these primary dealer banks and their liquidity and all that kind of stuff. So I don't see how the Fed changes course from here. The world looks different, obviously, with this rate cut today than it was even yesterday, but we've got an FOMC that begins 2 weeks from today. I don't know. You want to stick your neck out and try to postulate what you think is going to happen there?
Well, the market's already priced for another 25 basis points on March 18th. Mm-hmm. And, the Fed probably goes 25 or maybe goes 50. I think we are going to the zero bound. And actually, the Fed doesn't even call it the zero bound anymore. They call it the lower bound because they're not even sure if they might have to follow Europe and go negative.
Right.
I'm not saying that's what they'll do. And there could be all sorts of other legal complications in the United States, unlike Europe, where there's constraints on going below zero. But let's just say that the Fed is going to continue to cut rates. I think they showed their hand today that they will be very aggressive. I'd say that probably they're surprised at how the market's closed today. And I think most people are surprised about that. You know, the stock market popped when the Fed cut rates this morning, made the announcement. And, you know, you'd be sitting there saying, okay, that makes sense. We probably get, you know, a one-day rally out of this. And instead, we just like rolled over almost immediately. And maybe that's the market just saying that, that this isn't a monetary policy issue to begin with. And it's not really going to help things out since interest rates aren't the antidote to the sort of constraint we're going to have on global economic activity going forward. So I think that's the message here. The message here is that interest rates will not be the answer, but the Fed will nonetheless do everything it takes to ease policy. And that tells me that they're going to have to be even more forceful. That's the message today, is that we will go back into much more aggressive quantitative easing. They may have to get into the business of direct lending. The one thing we know about this Fed in the post-Greenspan era, starting with Bernanke, is that they will be very creative, but they also will be very aggressive. And what it tells me is that the Fed is going to follow the rest of the world towards zero. The only reason why yields out the curve aren't where they are in, say, Europe and Japan, and in some cases they're either close to zero or they are below zero, is because where the Fed has been pegging the cost of overnight funds. Well, that game is over. So my sense is that yields are going to continue to go down. And I'm not sure if yields out the curve go below zero. They're below zero in several parts of the world, you know, whether it's Germany or the Netherlands or Switzerland. But there's no magical level here. You just have to know that until we get some sort of resolution to this health situation, that the trend is going to be towards lower interest rates.
Yeah.
And that's why you want to be positioned, is long duration, even at these low levels of interest rates. I think that the deflationary forces are going to continue to be very powerful here. And I think that if you have to be invested in the equity market, then you want to be in the relatively safe yield plays, whether that's REITs or whether that's telecom or whether that's, say, even the Canadian banks, over, I'd say, the U.S. banks. That's really how you want to be positioned. And gold, of course, has got this near-perfect inverse correlation with interest rates. And that will continue to be a very important hedge as yields go down and the uncertainty is sustained.
David, just one last question. I want to be respectful of your time. It's been a long day, man, I'm sure for you. And it's a series of long days. So just one last just quick question. You know, you mentioned earlier the Fed trying to, in a sense, grease the skids. They got it almost playing kind of a whack-a-mole, trying to, you know, worried about the corporate refinancing and the high yield debt and all this. You know, you also mentioned the net interest margin of the banks. And here we're moving down toward that, what do they call it, the effective lower bound, as you said. And we've already seen that stress play out, particularly in some of the European banks. You know, and Deutsche Bank got all the way down to 6, then it went up to 10, and now it's falling again back to 8. Is that a risk they can manage in the short term? You know, if you let that mole kind of pop up while they whack other ones back down? Or do you think, you know, this could be a real issue in the weeks and months ahead if interest rates trend to zero globally?
Yeah, I would say that just in a nutshell, the European banks in particular, and I would probably highlight Italy, doubly in particular, are definitely areas of concern. And that's one of the reasons why Italian bond yields are one of the few countries where that have been going up as opposed to down, is the concern over credit quality, not just at the government level, but also the implications for quality of credit and collateral within the Italian banking system. But yeah, European banks, if we go into a global recession, which I think that certainly the core fixed income markets have been telling you for most of this year, and especially today, we go into a recession, the European banks are going to be hit especially hard.
Yeah. And that has a whole different set of implications, doesn't it?
Well, it means that Christine Lagarde is going to have a lot of work cut out for her, and it means that this era of quantitative easing and central bank intervention and maybe capitalism going on a further sabbatical is going to be the major theme. Yeah. But once again, it probably tells me that if you want to own gold, maybe the most powerful pair trade is going to be to own gold in euro-denominated terms.
Well, it's already making new all-time highs.
And there's just sometimes that when a chart is doing what it's doing, is you want to buy on strength, and I would stick with that program.
David, I tell you what, it sure has been a pleasure to make your acquaintance. And I hope we can keep in touch. This is such a wildly unpredictable year. I just couldn't recommend strongly enough either following you on Twitter or for everybody listening to reach out to David, again, Rosenberg Research and Associates, and we'll certainly put the link to his firm on this site because, gosh, at a time like this, you just can't get enough objective information. And that's clearly what David does. David, look, I very much appreciate it. It's been a long day, and I really, really appreciate you sharing some time here at the end of the day. It's been great to visit with you.
Okay, well, it's great talking to you, too. And just a reminder that there's always a bull market in something, and the something is treasuries and is what I call the bond bullion barbell, because I love alliterations.
I like it.
Just to leave off with something that I'm positive on.
Yeah, I like it. All right, my friend. Again, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure's all mine.
And everybody, thank you for listening. We'll have another Thursday conversation next week.